Hello and welcome to Saver, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And we've got an interview for y'all today.
Yes, with one Stephen Satterfield. And as he likes to say, not that Stephen Satterfield, because there's a famous chef in Atlanta also by the name of Stephen Satterfield of Miller Union. He's not that one.
He's not that one. No, this Stephen Satterfield is the host of a new iHeartMedia podcast called Point of Origin, one that our executive producer, Christopher, is working on.
Yeah, and it's really cool, like the in-depth episode they did on rice.
We
think that you'll dig it because some similarities there, perhaps.
Absolutely. It's about food and travel.
And the point of origin.
And the point of origin
of the food.
Exactly.
Yeah. See?
So,
easy, makes sense.
Uh-huh. And Stephen is just a delightful human person. He was, Annie and I don't know if you can tell from our podcasting style, but we're both fairly, like, anxious human people. Our energy is usually, like, way up here. Mm-hmm. And Stephen was just so chill. He was so great to have in the studio. He calls himself a sommelier in recovery, which I love.
Yeah, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so we wanted to talk with him about this podcast and what brought him to it and some of the things that he's passionate about in terms of telling stories about food. So here we go.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
My name's Stephen Satterfield, and I am the co-founder of Whetstone Magazine, which is a magazine on food origins, culture, and anthropology. We also produce other kinds of media like short films and a podcast on the iHeartRadio podcast network called Point of Origin.
We were excited when we saw the description for Point of Origin come through. iHeart is developing a bunch of new food shows right now, but this one really caught our eye because it's about traveling and finding, how about you describe it? it sounds like it's really trying to get to the origin stories of these foods that are so frequently misreported or just unknown to the general population.
Totally, exactly that. We think that origin is really important, not just for novelty's sake, but because it's really about helping us understand the story of food. And we talk about the story of food as the story of humanity, right? So understanding origin stories around the things we eat and drink helps us better understand who we are, who our neighbors are, and hopefully build some kind of empathy through that understanding.
Yeah, those human connections. I mean, food is such an amazing way to approach that because, as irritated as I am sometimes that I have to eat every day.
I know, it's so hard.
Like more than once.
I know.
But no, food is this beautiful thing that connects us.
Totally. And it's just, it's a really generous and generative way to look at the world, right? So because it's the only shared connection that we all have as human beings, it's our only, I find, true common language, and in that we have the ability to talk about big ideas, simple ideas, family, memories, on and on. So I just find it to be so generous as a way of connecting with other people.
Yeah. And we tend to be so disconnected from our food these days. Like everything comes in a plastic package or in a plastic package within a box, or mm-hmm. and we don't it's really easy to not think about it.
Yeah. Very much by design too, right? Like it is much easier to commoditize food than it is to perpetuate a culture in which people are growing their own food and preparing their own food. And, you guys have probably done episodes on this around like everything from supermarkets to refrigerators, that commodification is no coincidence. But it wasn't so long ago when people in our country raised their own food and prepared their own food for each meal.
Yeah. Was there like a Is there like a moment or maybe a set of experiences where you sort of realized how problematic this larger commodification food industry is and like how many stories aren't being told?
Yeah, God, I don't well, let me back up. So my work, I feel, in some way has always tried to find a point of irritation or agitation in the industry and trying to use my work to exploit it or bring light to it, however you like. My first real vocation was as a sommelier. So I went to culinary school in Portland, Oregon, and I worked in, you know, some fancy restaurants, and I became a sommelier. And that's really where I learned through the notion of terroir. That's how I came to origin as a kind of organizing principle, not just in agriculture, but a way to think about the world. You know, it's really kind of a profound lens to view the world when you think about an organizing principle of a sense of place and all of the different environmental conditions and input that ultimately will tell the story of, you know, whatever this food is, or wine most commonly. And so after working in the wine industry for a while, I started to look at the human element as part of the terroir and started asking some difficult questions about the South African wine industry in particular. In a post-apartheid industry and country, what did it mean for me as an African-American sommelier to kind of be a part of this post-apartheid story? And was I really satisfied with my role in that? And so I started a nonprofit organization that really used wine as a catalyst for socioeconomic development in South Africa, working with Black and Indigenous winemakers. And started to make media really on their behalf in that process, which is what brought me into making media. But I think also just for me, helped me understand that food or even wine, things that we look at as esoteric or purely rooted in pleasure or sustenance, are actually like really profound. And you can pursue things that are interesting to you and that you love, but also, you know, complicate things a bit for the rest of the industry as well.
Yeah. I feel like about once a week at least, there's some moment where we'll be researching something that seems relatively innocuous.
Mm-hmm.
And we go, oh no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh no. Humans, and specifically white people. Like, it's usually like the white people moment. It's just the, and then white people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think with that, it's because mostly the story of food is, it's a migration story, right?
Yeah.
And so you're talking about the migration of people, of plants, animals, and ideas or knowledge, right? And so we can't not talk about colonization and talk about food, because it explains why we eat what we eat and mm-hmm. how those things got here.
Yeah.
And when you read about colonization and the countries that were doing the colonizing, then, you know, if people are not prepared to confront those truthful histories, it can really cause like an identity crisis for people or some uncertainty. And it's like, keep your politics out of my food kind of thing. But that's just the way, that's the way that it is. And so, as I was saying earlier, you know, food, even though I think it is kind of difficult to confront stuff and like really, you know, blunt terms to say like, yeah, white people did some dumb stuff in the past. From a historical lens, it's sort of a continuation of an older story. I do think that food is somehow allows us to talk about the past more honestly than like something, let's say, like, well, I won't give any other examples. I'll stick to food. But yeah, I'll just say it gives us an opportunity to confront it honestly.
Yeah, yeah. And through something, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, it's, I guess it makes it a little bit of a softer blow that at the end of a terrible episode, you get to kind of be like, but banana bread is so delicious. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was the, you know, for me with this wine nonprofit that I had, it was really, I felt a superpower that we had where we would kind of invite people in to talk about wine, and we would do wine tastings, and we'd say, like, oh, everyone loves wine, and, you know, it would be, like, super educational. And then we would start talking about the history of the South African wine industry and how it was colonized by the Dutch. And then we started talking about, you know, the subsequent agricultural systems that followed of disenfranchisement and indigenous people being kept on the land. And so in the course of this wine tasting, you know, we have gone from, like, this really aspirational 1%, at least the perception of it, of course, that's not at all true, product to, like, now a really sobering conversation around the ways in which their decisions as consumers of wine, you know, still had an impact and were still part of this longer colonial story. And, like, that I was always so impressed with people's capacity to kind of stay with me, you know, along that journey of, like, we're just here drinking wine and now we're talking about how this wine came to be.
Yeah.
And I have no doubt that if that same engagement began with, like, I want to tell you about some difficult history, it would just be like, I wasn't there. It has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
And I don't want anything to do with that, like, story to sully my wine experience.
Yeah. We found that people are so generous with us all the time with their stories and with I think that people who are in the industry are really looking for a way to talk about it, for a reason to talk about it, to talk about these stories and to get them out there. And I think that there's a little bit of a stigma against it, you know, like keep your politics out of my food, like, you know, don't make this. But it's inherently political. And especially if you're working with that every day, if that's your mode of living, then, you know.
Inherently. I mean, you said it, right? There's no way in which food cannot be politicized, if for no other reason that we've already gotten regulations around food. So it's like, sorry. And, you know, when you see the news and there's a chicken processing facility and there's 700 workers that are rounded up and, you know, if you read the backstory about the fight that the workers were already engaged in with the owners of that processing facility, these politics are very much inherent. And so instead of – and I think actually – I guess on a slightly brighter note, in food media, I have found that this is an amazing kind of almost renaissance period in terms of inclusion and upliftment and really just a broader intellectual curiosity around global foodways, you know, from different narrators and orators. Certainly, like, as someone who publishes an independent magazine, other magazine editors who are getting opportunities are not at all the same as those of even 10 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And a lot of the reasons that I even started Whetstone, you know, I really felt like there was a redundancy in subject matter in food media. It was very much about chefs and restaurants and rankings and reviews, and most of the chefs and restaurants and rankings and reviews were all of the similar ilk. They went to the same culinary schools.
Yeah. And what cupcakes they're making right now.
Exactly. And so just like that felt so tedious and, you know, looking at global foodways felt less possible not that long ago. And now I think because of the spread of information and the technology that we have, and travel, of course, right? We, again, kind of an updated migration story for us because we are still moving. We are still part of the story of food. You know, we're still moving ideas and we are migrating and visiting and sharing information. And so the story of food is changing. And I think especially here in the U.S., becoming a more diverse and more interesting story.
Absolutely. That's so interesting. I've never thought about the internet as being a form of migration, as being parallel to the, you know, widespread migration of ideas that were happening in the past due to these, like kind of terrible money-related interests of greed. But now, yeah, we can have interplay between these cultures that there never has been before.
Totally. Yeah, I think you see it very often in on restaurant menus or tasting menus. You know, you'll see one chef, let's just say for the sake of conversation, in Copenhagen. And then all of a sudden, you know, one style of plating, which the first time you see it on, let's just say, Instagram, you know, it looks really like otherworldly, or you haven't seen it before, or what are these ingredients, or, oh, that's an interesting use of negative space on the plate. And the next thing you know, there's like restaurants all over Europe and all over the US who are now kind of mimicking this same style or same ingredients. And obviously there's some potential pitfalls within there, but I think that there's enough inherent curiosity and imagination, and really, again, technique. Like, I think the skill set even of a lot of young chefs, because of the amount of information that they've been able to absorb. You know, you used to have to go to libraries. Like, when I got into food, when I was in culinary school in Portland, you know, I was going to, like, Powell's books and reading about Charlie Trotter, you know, for front of house wine service.
Yeah.
And, like, when you think about YouTube and all, I mean, using YouTube as its own kind of search engine, the amount of information is just staggering. So
yeah,
the consumer is more sophisticated, and I think overall it'll be beneficial.
Oh, gosh, I hope so.
Well, there's so many other terrible things about the internet. The least it could do for us is make us more more sophisticated consumers of food.
Absolutely. Yeah. The flip side to YouTube being a wretched hive of scum and villainy is maybe it can teach us to cook a little bit better.
We have some more for you listeners. But first, we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. Let's get back into the interview.
So you've gotten to speak to some really inspiring people about some really, really amazing stories. Do you have any? I mean, I, you know, without wanting to be like, so just, you know, no one needs to go listen to your podcast or or subscribe to the magazine or anything like that. But do you have any favorites or any like weird ones or any conflicting ones? Anything that stands out?
Let me think of some standout stories. We just did a 2-part. Series on rice. We called it Rice and Resilience.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And it was really kind of about rice across cultures and countries, how formative it is, not only as a staple food, but as a means of cultural identity. And so one of the episodes, I think it was our fourth one, we did with a woman in California in the Central Valley named Robin Coda. And she has Coda Family Farms, which her family, it's been in her family for over 100 years through Japanese internment. And so she talks about, you know, her grandfather, how he came to acquire the farm, his role as an innovating farmer, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, and basically losing the land and her family fighting to get it back. It's an extremely moving story. And then we also talked to my friend BJ Dennis, who is a chef and caterer in South Carolina. He's also kind of he's Gullah Geechee, so he is a historian, but also just a scholar of Gullah Geechee foodways. So we talked to him about the purlieu and some of those descendants, so to speak, of the Carolina gold rice tradition. So that was really cool. We learned about Manomen, which is a native American rice, which grows on the lakes, the Great Lakes districts in Michigan. So it's just a really simple example of how, you know, these single subjects across the world, there's so many different derivative stories, but there are also so much that is the same in those stories, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. Rice was... Right, rice was a big one. We tried to do a single episode about that.
Good luck.
It kind of broke my brain.
Yeah, right?
We were just like, oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Glabarima, sativa, Africa, Asia, like entire continents. But then there's offsprings. And again, you know, even the migration of these crops and the knowledge of farming.
Yeah.
It's just so, so endless. It's such a big topic.
Yeah. That's when I learned about before physics, which is a, like, BCE, BC. There's BP, before physics, that some scientists use.
Oh, wow.
And there was a paper about rice that had BP in it. I was like, what? Don't give me another confusing thing I've got to go look up now.
I did not know about the BP.
That was my first experience with it.
Wow. Well, it's kind of like, rice broke the brain of science, too.
Yeah. Like, we've got to come up with another way to mark time.
This thing is old.
It's true. So I was reading some of the stuff, your work online, and I loved it. Especially, like, you made me want, like, pizza and beer so bad.
Oh, yeah. That's my thing.
You succeeded. If that was your goal, you succeeded. So how did you go from, you went to culinary school, like what path did you think you were going to take? How did you go from sommelier to recovering sommelier, to writing and now podcast, magazine?
Yeah, certainly not the plan at all. I was in culinary school in Portland in the early 2000s, so 2003, which was a very exciting time to be in Portland. It was kind of when Portland was shaping its own identity as a culinary capital-ish. Outside of New York and San Francisco, it was kind of the creator of the, like, tatted, badass chef, like, hipster aesthetic. Like, I had a front row seat for all that. Mm-hmm. But also kind of a real updating, an effortless updating of, like, contemporary dining culture, which is to say better ingredients, more care for local ingredients, and also less formal dining. A lot of folks – I mean, this is happening in New York too, but I really feel – Portland was kind of the one driving this kind of aesthetic.
Yeah.
And so I learned a lot. And, of course, you know, being in Oregon means I was in the Willamette Valley, which is one of the world's great wine regions. It still is, in my opinion, some of the best wine on earth comes from the Willamette Valley. And so I had a chance to develop a relationship to nature that I'm not sure I could have if I – would have gone to culinary school in Atlanta, for instance, where I'm from. So no shade on Atlanta. I didn't really know what I didn't know, how much I didn't know, until the first time I went into a vineyard and I had a really intense epiphany around wine as agriculture, you know, as an agrarian thing. And then I started to think about everything in terms of agriculture. And honestly, I haven't really stopped thinking about that since. And I was 19 years old at the time. And so I thought probably I would maybe own a restaurant one day. I wanted to be a chef for a while. I did a lot of cooking on the side too. But it was so hard, you know. I mean, I knew enough to know that, like, if given the choice of drinking or, like, you know, cooking food for hours at a time for half the amount of money. Like, sorry, guys. I'll cook for my friends and family at home. So, I pretty quickly moved into, like, front of house restaurant operation stuff and wine stuff. And, you know, you heard a little bit about the detour in South Africa. And I think, you know, media right now, as I alluded to, you know, there's the industry is so different. I could have never produced or even had a vision of kind of publishing my own magazine or having my own media company or certainly not podcasting. And also the way that people regarded food, and I guess that was like 15 years ago, was so different. You know, it was like still kind of an esoteric field, was scarcely looked at as a career, a viable career choice. And that's really been one of the most amazing things to me over the last decade is to see how people have really centered food and culinary arts as part of like broader popular culture.
Yeah. Yeah. It was still really like inapproachable for a while. Like we were in this kind of like dark age between like the Julia Childs of the world and the modern food TV personalities.
Totally.
Could you talk a little bit about what you ate growing up and why you decided to go into the culinary field in the first place?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, my eating growing up was really good, I think. On the whole, my dad cooked for us. So I did grow up with the image of a man in the kitchen, which I think matters. And I, you know, we made Southern food. Like, so I'm fifth generation, as I said. So macaroni and cheese and collards and rice. But, you know, my parents are also middle-class working people, so there is a lot of, like, hybrid dinners with stuff from cans and cardboard boxes, too. But I do remember, like, on the weekends, my dad would always make us a breakfast from scratch of pancakes and eggs and bacon. So my dad loved cooking. He's really good at smoking meats and barbecuing. And so for all family functions, our house was always kind of the HQ for holiday functions. So I think there probably was something in there, you know, around being convivial and entertaining as much as, you know, cooking. He also, in very classic fashion of the South, he would cook at church as well. So, like, I have memories of my dad frying fish and chicken for like hundreds of people.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I think, and that those are my, that is kind of what brought me to food ultimately is being able to think about it as a thing to share, you know, with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about that the other day too, because my mom always, she does the big church meals.
Right.
And when it comes to thinking about people coming together, and like you did with the wine, having these kind of more political conversations, like having that thing to come together and share, I think, and seeing people with different political views kind of discuss and say, oh, this is a person too, and I don't have to just kind of paint them as I don't know them or they're different than me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite true. I mean, one of my biggest annoyances in life is because I've been living in California, you know, for the last 10 years. And Californians who have been to every corner of the earth, to freaking Fiji, to any corner. And, you know, they talk about the South in these terms of like gasp, you know, like... Yeah. Oh, you're from Georgia. Like, what is it like?
Clutching their pearls.
I'm like you guys, you ought to be ashamed, you know, like the way that you're just telling on yourself, because the truth of the matter is having lived in allegedly the most progressive places in the country, Portland, San Francisco, Southerners have a lot more figured out in the way of how to deal with each other on a human level. And I'm talking about in black and white terms, than people in California or Portland ever have. And the reason for that is because in the South, we have, even post-segregation and even, you know, leading up to segregation, we have always had black people and white people in the South living next door to each other. Mm-hmm. And even though at different points in that history, a lot of those white folks would have preferred for that not to be the case, it was still the case. And, you know, I really think that whatever my own beliefs are or non-beliefs about the church or certainly my politics are very divergent, you know, from the whole of the state of Georgia and our governor. But when I'm here, I see a kind of civility and decency in the way that black people and white people, obviously there's more than that, but that's what we're talking about. And that's yeah. kind of what the insinuation is when people in California or Portland are asking me, like, for you, you know? And yeah. so the implication is that the South is just a bunch of toothless white people who vote for Donald Trump. And I'm like, first of all, you're erasing an entire history. Like, the reason that I'm saying that I'm fifth generation Atlanta, because I'm saying that my family has been here for 200 years almost. Like, I am a patriot, you know? I'm an American, more so than many of the people who would be looking at me as anything other than that,
yeah.
right? And so I really feel strongly in not, like, defending the South in any way, but anytime people from allegedly liberal parts of the country have really fast and flippant opinions about the South, I always like to ask them, when's the last time you were there? And it's shocking how few times that they've actually been able to say, oh, I've been there, not to mention recently, but ever been there at all. So I feel, yeah, the South has its own complications, but I'm really, really glad that I'm from here. And I would, as much as I've traveled and as much as I love the places that I have lived, and those are wonderful cities, I would not trade the experience of really facing that kind of black and white dichotomy, because it really informed who I am. It informed this work with the nonprofit that I was doing. And it really helps me, you know, when I am critical about my neighbors, right? Like, I feel like I have some authority on that. And it's so easy for people in other places to say how they would respond because their politics or their ideas about who they are really are not being challenged in practice.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to deal with it here. Mm-hmm. And I feel really lucky. I've been here for about 14 or 15 years now, but I'm originally from Northern Ohio and the New Jersey part of South Florida. And so, like, coming here was such a revelation. I was like, okay, cool. But it opened my eyes to so many different modes of so many different food ways and so many different modes of communication amongst those food ways. I don't know. It's Atlanta's a beautiful city. I'm like, oh, I guess I live here now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like the only liberal person in a very small town in Georgia. And I didn't realize how much I internalized this kind of like, the South is a terrible place, because I tried to get rid of my accent. Mm-hmm. I was ashamed to tell people I was from the South. And it was just because I had that kind of like knee-jerk reaction that people have from outside of the United States. And I'm glad that I've gotten over that. And I've traveled a lot and I've been to a lot of other places now. And I still feel like, oh, this is a really, I was lucky to be around in this once I got to Atlanta. And I was like, oh, wow.
Totally.
There's so much good food and there's so much diversity in a way that I don't frequently experience.
Yeah, I agree. So we love you, Atlanta. It's complicated as you are.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
It would be real nice if we could work our elections out. But.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's true. That's
also
very true.
And we have a little bit more of this interview left. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
So you've written on several things that we've done episodes on, like food deserts. And we recently did one on food waste. How do you choose your topics?
Well, these days, I'm writing less than ever.
Yeah.
Because podcasting is hard.
Yeah, everybody.
Well, I mean, podcasting is writing too.
Yeah, like, that's yeah, the. That's I true. Think that's been the big reveal for me. You huh. know, is mm-hmm. that podcasting is just tons of writing. So, but I think you know, I really have just always thought about food really broadly. You know, it makes sense in my brain to talk about food access. In the same way, it makes sense to talk about food waste, because if you pay attention to food, then you know these are really like enormous issues that are facing the country and the world right now. And so I've never felt like I had the luxury to just pick and choose the parts of food or alcohol, as it were, that I wanted to pay attention to. And so if you want to write really smart criticism about chefs and restaurant trends, then you ought to also be able to write with the same authority and insight on the, you know, food politics and the matters of food politics that will affect you, your community, and the world around you. And, you know, for writers that aren't able to do that, I think like there's some missing context in how far they can really take us in our education around food.
Yeah. I saw on your Twitter you've been talking about orange wine.
Oh yeah. there's a little dust up in the wine world. It's just so silly. I don't fully understand it. But it's totally a thing. So there was a New Yorker article that came out a couple weeks ago. The gentleman who wrote the article basically had a bad experience with orange wine. Mm-hmm. And he used his platform at the New Yorker to tell the world, I had a bad experience with orange wine. Which I felt was kind of beneath the New Yorker as a subscriber and a big fan of most of the content. Let me just say that. It just seemed really weird because obviously the reason it was being written about is because it's a topical thing. It is part of the natural wine conversation. Perhaps natural wine is even derivative of the orange wine trend. And so, you know, of course, I'm looking with great interest when the New Yorker decides to write about anything that I'm interested in, except this particular article was about absolutely nothing. And it's the wrong topic to kind of treat flippantly because for whatever reason, people are so passionate about natural wine and about orange wine. And so when you say you don't like orange wine, it is like a personal affront to legions of people who drink the wine or who are in the industry. And so my voice was one of many that day or the couple days after that article that was just saying like, what the hell, dude? What was that article?
Well, yeah, and it's so silly to be dismissive about an entire category of product based on, like, you're like, oh, man, I hate pizza because I had this Totino's and it was shite.
Imagine.
Like, what?
I know. It made no sense. And I also felt, you know, it was a missed opportunity. The reason that I feel – so I earlier – or I guess that was last year, we released – a short film from the Republic of Georgia called Wild Grapes, Whetstone did. And I went to the Republic of Georgia. I've been twice. Can't recommend it enough, which is, as far as we know, where the origins of viticulture begin, because I am a self-proclaimed origin forager. I care a lot about wine. So it really felt important to me to go see like the oldest vineyards in the world and where it all came from. And so we made a film, a really beautiful film with this grower who named Georgie, and he is in this village, which we think is where the oldest vineyards in the world are. And a lot of the indigenous, one of hundreds of indigenous grape varieties to Georgia, were destroyed during the Ottoman occupation and many centuries later during the Soviet occupation. And so it's kind of a dark part of the history is when people occupy Georgia, one of the things that they do is attack their vineyards because it's such an important part of their cultural history and identity. So it's a really demeaning thing that happens. And so this guy, Georgie, who's probably in his mid-30s, for the last 8 years or so has been going around the village and climbing trees and mountains and finding these old grapevines and vines that were thought to have been extinct and then bringing them back as, you know, they were hundreds of years ago. So we made a film about this guy. And in the process, you learn that this white wine grape, Cazzatelli, is this ubiquitous white wine grape in Georgia, and literally everyone makes it in their backyard. And essentially it's a skin contact white wine. That's just what an orange wine is. And so you have it for every meal. And it's so common that it's like it would be no different than someone offering you a glass of water, you know, when you go to their home. And so I really felt like this article missed an awesome opportunity to get to connect this, you know, 8,000-year history, and something that they're framing as a trend story is actually how wine has been made without interruption in this place for 8,000 years. And instead, what he really ended up doing was talking about a gentrification story, if anything. He's in some hipster restaurant and he's ordered some wine that he didn't like. And in conclusion, orange wine is for dummies. He didn't say that, but still, that's how it felt.
That was the attitude.
Yeah, I'm reading it. Creative license. So yeah, that was, then I was out there tweeting about it.
I enjoyed. I didn't know this was a thing, so I learned a lot.
Yeah, people really care.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yay for people caring on Twitter. It's one of those other things. It's a double-edged sword.
Oh, yeah. I only try to speak up on the really important matters like orange wine.
Absolutely.
I stay out of the weeds on everything else.
But orange wine, you were there.
Yeah, no, I'm willing to show up for that.
Yeah, is there, what do you have on the horizon other than like this podcast? Any like trips planned or anything?
Good question. right now, we're working on a couple projects that are about the migration story of African people. So this year marks the 400-year anniversary, I think we can call it that, of the arrival of the very first enslaved person in this country. And so some of the work that we're starting to do is looking more closely at the story of the food of the African diaspora over the 400-year period because, you know, when you get into the Caribbean, West Indies, Brazil, Texas, Southeast, those stories are so different. And those traditions are so distinctive for all those places, but it is all derivative of the continent. So we're working on some film projects that are looking at that. And then we have our fifth volume of Whetstone, and there will be plenty to see and talk about in that next one.
Awesome.
Awesome, yeah. Is there anything that we haven't asked you about that's just burning on your mind that you really want to say into a microphone right now?
No, just that Savor podcast is awesome and that I'm so honored to be on the show. I love how rigorous you guys are about learning about where food comes from. You know, ultimately, it's the same work that inspires me. So I love your show and thanks for having me on.
Oh, of course.
We're so thrilled. I think in the email, I was like, what?
Yes.
Like, really?
Put him, come on.
Oh, absolutely. Where can people find you?
You can find me on the Instagram at Whetstone Magazine. So Whetstone is Whetstone, which it's a sharpening stone. That could be an episode for you guys. Whetstone. There's so much there.
Oh, yeah.
Whetstone Magazine. And then I'm at I Saw Steven which is S-T-E-P-H-E-N. And both Whetstone Magazine and I Saw Stephen are all over the internet.
Yes. And also can check out the podcast.
Oh, of course. from the iHeart Studios. Yes. And I'm the host of the Point of Origin podcast, which you can listen to every Thursday.
Everywhere that fine podcasts are found.
That's right. Thanks for filling that crucial part.
We're here to help.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's a delight. Mm-hmm. We've arrived at the end of this, our interview with Stephen Satterfield. We hope that you found it as soothing and informative and just wonderful as we did.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And if you want to check out the Point of Origin podcast, it is as Savor is on all those places that we say at the end of every show.
Absolutely. Same places. Yeah. I think you should check it out because they're doing great work over there. And,
yeah.
Stephen was so, so nice. And I appreciated that he spoke highly of our show, too.
Oh, I know.
I was like,
right?
Oh, no. I was like, I'm going to melt into this chair.
Right. I was like, you've listened to us? Why would anyone ever do that?
But keep listening, listeners.
But please.
yeah, and you can also email us on top of listening to the show.
Yes.
Our email is hello@savorpod.com.
Or reach out to us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all three places at SavorPod. We do hope to hear from you. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.